terrific programs. Please call 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org to make your gift today. And a huge thanks to you if you've already made a gift this month.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Michelle Martin is away. We want to begin the program today talking about Iraq. Militants attacked and now reportedly control much of the country's northern part of the country, and violence continues to spread. By now, you may have heard of ISIS, the militant group behind the recent violence. It's a group of Sunni fighters that want to create an Islamic empire across the Middle East. We wanted to hear more about how this group is gaining ground in Iraq using part social media tactics and obviously violence, and what its rise there could mean for the rest of the Middle East. Joining us now to talk more about it is Shadi Hamid. He's the Brookings Institution Fellow for the Project on U.S.-Islamic World Relations, and his new book is called Temptations of Power, Islamist and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Shadi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also here in the studio is Nadia Owadat. She's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and researches youth and internet in the Arab Spring. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shadi, I'm going to start with you, give you a little advantage because you're on the phone here. Refresh our memories about exactly who ISIS is and how this group came to flourish in Iraq.
Sure. So ISIS is actually a product of previous conflicts. They gained a lot of ground in the Syrian conflict, and they actually became so extreme that Al-Qaeda Central disavowed them. No one's more vicious and brutal in their tactics and in their harsh implementation of Sharia law than ISIS. But ISIS is different in the sense it's not like old-style Al-Qaeda, 9/11, and after that, where it was pretty much about destroying things. ISIS has been able to control territory. It's trying to govern. It's providing security for citizens, often in a very harsh way. But it is a bit of a different model than the kind of terrorist blowing up model that I think a lot of Americans were used to previously.
And Nadia, I want to talk a little bit more about this because obviously there is a very rocky connection between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And as we just heard Shadi say, that Al-Qaeda sort of rejects the ISIS theology. But
is
that true?
Actually.
Yeah, what's the connection there?
Basically, what happened between ISIS and Al-Qaeda is really a power play. There's a lot of big egos from within the jihadi scene, and they're competing for power. And somebody refused to give blind obedience to Baghdadi, who is now the head of ISIS. He ridiculed the Wahiri, and he wanted actually to assassinate Al-Qaeda, all of their members in Syria. So you have somebody who's so brutal, he cannot tolerate dissent. So it really is a power play. It really is a group that does wants to rule alone. It's very authoritarian. So it's not so much that they are too violent for Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has no problem killing civilians. It killed with cold blood 3,000 plus civilians. It really is about who's in control. And we will see this go on because there's so much infighting, in fact, that is now being covered by Wiki Baghdadi, basically somebody from within leaking this infighting. But you can see it happened in Afghanistan. It happened again in Iraq, which caused the Sahwa councils. It happened in Syria. And it will happen also in Iraq.
Shadi, I want to talk more about this. You just heard Nadia saying Wiki Baghdadi, which is someone releasing documents from inside ISIS. But this gets at the issue of Sunni extremism and Sunni militants. Who exactly is the constituency for ISIS within Iraq? Who's really supporting this group?
Sure. Well, I think we're entering a Salafi jihadi moment, if you will, where more moderate Islamist groups across the Middle East have lost popularity. They tried to come to power through democratic elections, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but for a variety of reasons, that didn't work out so well. So now we're seeing these jihadist groups that are quite violent, and they're essentially saying to their constituents that violence works. Violence is the only way. Democratic elections are a waste of time. And that has some appeal, but I think more generally, in a place like Iraq, you have such anger at the central government, which is dominated by the Maliki government, which is Shia. So there's a real sectarian element where they look at Maliki and they can't stand him, so they're being pushed into the arms of Sunni extremist groups. Now, if these Iraqis live under ISIS rule, they might change their mind, but at least in this initial phase, there has been some embrace on the local level of these Sunni militants. And it's not just ISIS, but also a number of other smaller groups as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about recent violence in Iraq and the rise of the militant group ISIS. With us now, that's Shadi Hamid of the Brookings Institution. And now here's Nadia Owidat of the New America Foundation. And Nadia, I gather you have a slightly different take on sort of where the moderates are in all of this.
I do. If I may first comment on my colleague's observation. You know, we've actually never had democracy in the Arab world. We've never had equal citizenship. And even when the Brotherhood were in power, they very much disenfranchised everybody else. So I would not say that this Salafi jihadist movement is a reaction to the fail of democracy, because democracy never actually took place.
You're talking about a liberal democracy the way maybe Americans think of it.
Right. But what is happening in Iraq, he's definitely right about the government of Maliki, which could not possibly be part of the solution. If the U.S. thinks that it can wrap this problem with Maliki, they are really not in touch with reality, because Maliki is so unpopular, he is so part of the problem, that he is causing sworn enemies to be united against him. Sufis, who are, again, all jihadists from their inception in the 80s, were very much against Sufis. And Baathis, they were, when I was reading Al-Qaeda papers that came out of Afghanistan, the Baathists were number one enemy, sworn enemy to Al-Qaeda. And both are uniting with ISIS against Maliki's government and practices. So Maliki cannot be part of the solution. On the moderates, if you look, for example, 80% of the Arab world is under 40, and 70% is under 30, and most of whom are not married. If you look at the most popular Facebook pages, the most popular YouTube channels, they're very secular. They're very, very much secular. The top five, for example, Facebook pages include following Hollywood movies, includes National Geographic in Abu Dhabi, so includes one page called Educate Yourself. So this does not reflect the inclination of the majority, but they do reflect funding and support by certain groups to such tendencies.
Obviously, there's going to be more conversation about those sectarian divisions over the coming weeks, and you are hearing lawmakers talk more and more about whether Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki should go. I want to jump on something you mentioned there, Nadia, though, about social media. Obviously, social media has been very popular with Islamist extremists around the region. Shadi Hamid, what does ISIS do differently? Why do they stand out?
Yeah, so I think the important thing about social media to understand is, you know, when the Arab Spring started, there was a lot of excitement that these are young English-speaking revolutionaries who are using Twitter and Facebook, and we saw technology as being part of this great future. But the point about social media is that the bad guys can use it too, including terrorists in this case. And they've been able to have a presence on Twitter and Facebook and to be able to distribute their messages in real time to a larger audience through a variety of different accounts. It's hard to always track which account belongs to which group and so on, but the presence is definitely there. We've seen jihadists more generally post 9/11 really being able to adapt to new kinds of technology. I mean, these are some pretty technologically savvy guys as retrograde as they might otherwise be.
Yeah, just to let Nadia jump in here, I mean, this is a group that has hashtag campaigns. They had an app in the Android store. What are they doing here that's so striking?
Well, actually, again, all jihadists, and in fact, political Islam in general, have always been media conscious, have always paid extra attention to their picture in the media, to their propaganda. So they've had 20 years to really hone their skills and really be good at it. But I want to say that because of that, they were, in fact, most of the time ahead of the game. They were the ones who were monopolizing the internet in Arabic. So a few years ago, the only thing you could see in Arabic, in addition to maybe some newspaper websites, is Islamist and jihadist and Wahhabi content. That's it. It monopolized. The new development, in fact, is not that, oh, they are using the internet. The new development is that, oh, the internet is also now being used by liberal forces and human rights forces. And in fact, they are, again, they have way more audience. It's important to keep that in mind, that if you look at the entire presence, they are losing, in fact. They don't have, by not even close to being, they're not even close to being popular by even a big minority.
But they've certainly drawn tremendous attention with some of the grisly videos that they've posted
of
a mass execution and people trying to verify this. I mean, they're very savvy.
They are very brutal. And in fact, their brutality shows their how disconnected they are from the wider Arab audience. Because if they think this will gain them popularity, they are truly disconnected.
Shadi?
If I could just jump in, I'm not sure if popularity really matters to these groups. They're not trying to be these mass populist movements that are well-liked and adored. They believe that, that violence works in the sense they instill fear in the local populations, and that creates for them a better situation as they see it, where they're able to control. And so if you judge it based on that, there has actually been considerable success. I mean, we're talking about a very large swath of territory in Iraq and Syria that are governed directly by these groups. Liberals can't claim that anywhere in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, the more moderate Islamist groups haven't been able to claim territory either. So, I mean, unfortunately, we're living in a time and in a region where violence works. That's the sad fact of it.
I'm sorry. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Shadi Hamid is a Brookings Fellow for the Project on U.S. Islamic World Relations. His new book is called Temptations of Power, Islamist and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. He joined us from Oslo, where he's traveling. And Nadia Ouedat, she's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and researches youth and internet in the Arab Spring. She was with us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office called the Washington Redskins' name disparaging to Native Americans and canceled the team's trademark registration. We'll dig into sports law and find out just what this might mean for the league and the controversial team name. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
Welcome to whatever this is.
On the next Fresh Air, John Oliver, the former Daily Show correspondent who hosted last summer while Jon Stewart directed his movie, now has his own show of political satire on HBO called Last Week Tonight. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes unique and independently owned specialty shops and restaurants like Pieto and Pieto 2, Tang Dynasty, and The Great Impasta.
I'm Audie Cornish. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. So it looks like we can all start selling our homemade Redskins gear on the internet. Anybody got requests? That was one of the many joking reactions from Twitter users yesterday, shout out to Josh Katsowitz, about the decision to cancel the Washington NFL team's trademark registration. The ruling came down from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, which said the trademark registration the team has had on that name since 1967 was disparaging to Native Americans. Lawyers for the team say they will definitely appeal. But given the political pressure on the team to drop the name, we wanted to know just how important this latest legal twist is. So we've called upon Professor Gabriel Feldman. He's the director of the Sports Law Program at Tulane University, and he joins us from member station WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
So first, clarify for us. I understand this was a rejection of the trademark on the name Redskins, not the logo. And if the decision is upheld, right, if Washington, say, loses its appeal, would they be able to stop people from selling their own team merchandise?
They might. That's still a bit of an open question. And the ruling was with respect to the Redskin name, but also to with respect to two different logos, not all of the logos they use. So there are some logos in there. But if this gets upheld on appeal, and remember back in 2003, district court reversed a very similar finding of the board. But if it's upheld on appeal, this doesn't mean that the team can't use the name. But what it does mean is it's more difficult for them to prevent other people from using the name.
So they have a tough time in terms of legal recourse.
Yeah. I mean, beyond federal trademark law, there's also common law rights and state law rights that would allow the Redskins or the team to enforce exclusivity over the name. It's more difficult to do it. It's more expensive to do it, but it's still possible. So this doesn't mean the end of exclusivity. This doesn't mean that all of a sudden everyone can just start making their own Redskins apparel. I don't think this means that Adidas and Reebok are going to pop up and start making that apparel because of, I think, pressure from the league. So it's certainly a hit to the Washington team if this goes forward, if this is affirmed on appeal, but it doesn't mean right now, at least, the end of the name.
All right. So given what you've just said, how significant is this decision by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office? Obviously, they've been going back and forth with this office for a while.
It's significant because it's just yet another ruling from a board, from an official government agency, saying that this is an offensive term to Native Americans. I think it does add to the political pressure that has been growing. The question is, will it be enough to force Daniel Snyder to change the name of the team? Will it be enough to force the other 31 NFL owners and the commissioner to say, you have to change the name of the team, or to try to pressure him to change the name of the team? Will it cause fans or players or sponsors to turn on the team? I think it's going to take something along those lines to put economic pressure on the team to change the name. I don't think this by itself will force the change.
And for those of us who aren't familiar with the legal arguments here, does this in any way raise a First Amendment issue?
No, it doesn't. There's no First Amendment here because issue here. This is a question of just whether this is going to receive protection from the trademark board and registration, which will allow them to enforce exclusivity. This is actually saying that, in essence, more people can use the term. So it's actually, in some ways, encouraging others to use the term, not restricting people from using the term.
Let's take a step back for a minute. How important is the trademark business for any given pro sports team?
Well, the interesting thing about the NFL is we have 32 teams. They're interrelated. They depend on each other to create the NFL. And they share almost equally the licensing revenue that comes from sale of their trademarks. And so the 32 teams, minus really the Dallas Cowboys, share, and it's usually about $3 billion a year. And so if there is a negative hit economically because this term is now deemed offensive and fans will stop buying the apparel, that not only hurts the Redskins, it hurts the other 31 NFL teams. But compared to the television deals, this is a relatively small amount of money. So no one's going to go out of business in the NFL if they sell less apparel, but it could have somewhat of an impact both in the Redskins and the league and the 31 other teams.
Going even broader, if you hold the trademark right now for, say, the Florida State Seminoles or the Atlanta Braves or the Kansas City Chiefs, how closely are you watching this?
They've been watching this all along, and I think it's, again, probably more about the political and public pressure and the economic pressure, because this legal ruling, although significant and it's expensive to litigate it, it's expensive to go on appeal, it will then be more expensive to enforce their rights. I think the question is still, will fans turn on them? Will sponsors turn on them? Will the conference, will the league, will the NCAA turn on them? That just makes it economically unviable to continue using the term.
Now, the Washington team has been going back and forth with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, as you've said. And I read that since, like, the early 90s, the office has actually rejected applications to use the Redskins name in other places. So what are the chances of success for the Washington Redskins appeal?
Well, it's a great question, and it was the same question we had in 2003 when the district court reversed the trademark board finding then. There are some different arguments here, and the real question is going to be whether the district court is convinced that the plaintiffs brought forward evidence to show a substantial composite of Native Americans are offended or disparaged by the term. And we had two members of the trademark board find that it was sufficient evidence, one that found that it didn't, and then we'll see what a district court judge says. But it's impossible to predict how that ruling will come down.
Give us a little background in the time we have left about the folks who have brought this most recent case.
Well, what's interesting about this most recent case is one of the reasons the original case brought back in 1992 by the Harjo class was rejected was because the district court and in part one of the board found that they waited too long to bring the claim. And so this new group was formed in part to represent a younger class of plaintiffs that didn't delay, that didn't wait because they were too young to wait. They could not have brought the claim earlier. So in many respects, it represents very similar arguments, similar claims as the first class, mm-hmm. but is a younger class to avoid that delay argument.
Gabriel Feldman, he's an associate professor of law and the director of the sports law program at Tulane University Law School. Thanks so much for explaining it to us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Today is Juneteenth. It's a celebration commemorating the end of slavery and dates back to 1865. Around the country, some towns are celebrating with festivals and events. In Asheville, North Carolina, an effort is being made to do more in remembering the city's slave history. A team of archaeologists is using technology to map grave sites in a cemetery that served the Black community in that city for generations. Joining me to talk more about the project is Jeff Keith. He's a professor at Warren Wilson College. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Adi.
So tell us a little bit more about this cemetery. Where is it situated, and what kind of condition is it in these days?
Well, the cemetery is actually in the middle of Asheville, not in the middle of the city downtown, but as the city has developed, it's on top of Beaucatcher Mountain, situated really in the center of town, and it's in what is now a neighborhood known as Kenilworth. If you can imagine, there are no roads that approach it. It was in the woods when it was established. And the cemetery has, over the years, fallen into disrepair, beginning in the 40s when it was closed.
Any markers, really?
There are about 100 markers with names on them. This is deceptive, though, because the actual cemetery is the final resting place for at least 2,000 people. So most of the markers that you find there are kind of unconventional. Field stones on their end, sometimes wooden crosses that, of course, have over time rotted, but you can tell where some of the crosses were, and other markings. Sometimes people planted trees. So it looks to most people like a field with some stones in it. But when you look closer or know to look closer, you realize there are many people there.
So you're saying estimated 2,000, and I understand looking at the Google Earth program that you guys have developed that actually indexes the grave sites, you see lots of little black lines, like little strike marks. Does each of these represent a grave?
Yes, it does, and that's what's kind of astonishing. Before we made this map and put it on Google Earth, we still had a map, per se. It was a flat 2D representation of the 1,961 graves that in the 1990s, a team of archaeologists went out, and they probed the earth and actually discovered where all these graves were. But it wasn't on a map like it is now in terms of being represented in geographical space. Now we can see where it's situated in the context of Asheville as a whole.
I want to talk a little bit more about the people that were buried there. I understand during the kind of New Deal era WPA writers' projects, they actually found the stories of some of the folks who eventually came to rest there, like Sarah Gudger. We have a little sound from writings from her that's read here by an actor.
One day, I never forget it, we look out and see soldiers marching. Looked like the whole valley full of them. I thought, poor helpless critters just going away to get killed. The drums was beating and the fifes were playing. There was a foot company. Oh, glory. It was a sight.
Jeff Keith, tell us a little bit more about her.
Sarah Gudger is an amazing woman. She was born, we think, around 1816. This is what's astonishing. If she was born in 1816, then she was interviewed in 1937 by Marjorie Jones, who's part of the New Deal WPA Federal Writers Project. And at that point, Sarah Gudger would have been 120. And this means, too, that she, unlike a lot of the people who were interviewed for the WPA slave narratives, had adult memories of being a slave. That recollection of soldiers marching through the fields would have, of course, been in the 1860s. By then, she would have been in her 40s.
Now, I understand there's also a story behind the longtime caretaker for the cemetery, a man by the name of George Avery. He would eventually be buried there himself. He really stepped up in a community that wasn't taking care of this resting place.
George Avery, he was born around 1844 and belonged to William Wallace McDowell, one of the largest slave owners in western North Carolina. He ended up, though, joining the Union Army, and this allowed him to gain a pension. And after the Civil War, he decided to return home, and he was caretaking the cemetery that he had been helping to run under McDowell. But he continued to maintain the cemetery until 1940. This is quite significant because it allowed George Avery to continue his work with the African-American community there, then a freedman. So the cemetery, it's important to point out, is both the final resting place for slaves who died under slavery, and many who were born into slavery died free, and some who even were born free.
Professor Keith, I know there are several attempts around the country to try and locate and map these kinds of slave burial sites. What's the danger of letting them go unchartered? I mean, what is the real value of preserving this history?
Well, Adi, I've been now to the South Asheville Cemetery many times with hundreds of people, and what I find is that when we walk out on the cemetery, it's a very important spiritual and historical site, and it raises questions. That's what I love about this place. It makes us ask questions, sometimes very difficult questions. Who were these people? Why is it that they don't have headstones? What is it that they contributed to this community? And how does that relate to contemporary issues of race and inequality? And to my mind, that's just a handful of the many questions we're able to ask because of these places. So it's really up to community groups, and in this case, the South Asheville Cemetery Association has brought in many to sort of nurture that collective memory about slavery.
Jeff Keith, he's a professor at Warren Wilson College. He joined us from his studio in Lexington, Kentucky. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Adi.
Now we turn to a regular feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we invite some of our guests to tell us about the songs that give them inspiration. Today, we're hearing from R&B sensation Miguel. He recently released a sexy music video for his single Simple Things, and that song will be on a new album that's set for release later this year. Miguel was with us a while back to talk about his breakout album, Kaleidoscope Dream, which featured the Grammy-winning single Adorn. And he told us then about the tracks he's been listening to.
They probably got me down by the end of the song. Seem like the whole city go against me. Every time I'm in the street, I hear yak, 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 yak.
Greetings, my name is Miguel, and this is what's in my ear. Right about now, one of my favorite songs to listen to while I'm driving is Mad City by Kendrick Lamar. He's also a Los Angeles native, a good friend of mine. He just put out a brand new album called Good Kid, Mad City. I think I love the driving force of the song, the storytelling perspective. It's interesting.
Not the drill sergeant, but the stress that weighing on your brain. It was me, El Boogie, yeah, yeah, YG Lucky. Ride down Rosecrans, it got ugly. Waving your hand out the window, check yourself. Warriors and coldness, hope euphoria can slow dance with society. The driver's seat, the first one to get killed. Seen a
light. Another song playing in my ear. It's a song by Glasser. The song is called Apply. It's got something tribal about the song, but still electronic. Singer's voice is just soaring over it, and there's something really primal about it that I love to listen to while I'm working out. But The last song playing in my ear is called Speakin' Rounds by Grizzly Bear.
If I draw you upside down, I can't let go.
They just put a new album out called Shield, which is an amazing album, which is kind of expected of Grizzly Bear at this point. They're an amazing band. I don't know, this entire album is really ethereal to me for some reason, and this is the first song I heard from it. A friend recommended it, and I don't know, I'll let you listen to it and let you figure out what you love about it.
That was R&B singer Miguel telling us what's playing in his ear. To hear Tell Me More's previous conversation with him, head over to NPR.org. Click on the Programs tab and go to Tell Me More. Coming up, William Bronner. He's been HIV positive for most of his life, but when he went away to college, he decided to keep that hidden from those closest to him, including his sexual partners.
The ones who could not forgive me and still cannot forgive me, I completely understand. You know, I took people's decisions away from them.
Now, Bronner's road to redemption is the subject of a new documentary, 25 to Life. We'll hear more from him. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, supporting the New Americans campaign and all their partners promoting citizenship. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young. Lending seeds to gardeners is now a mission that public libraries have taken on to help save the best of the past.
You look at seed catalogs from 100 years ago and you see things that just don't exist anymore.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
When you make the effort to visit rural Turkey, you can count on receiving an especially warm welcome.
Their livelihood is not the visitors, so they treat the visitors as personal visitor coming in, not a tourist that's planning to spend on money.
On the next edition of our weekly travel show, we visit Village Turkey, find out what's new in London, and see the sights of St. Petersburg.
Your jaws drops. It's something magical.
On Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Audie Cornish, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. This week, the American Black Film Festival kicks off with high-profile commercial fare, like Think Like a Man 2. But a film with an entirely different take on relationships and romance is also getting its first look at the festival, and it's called 25 to Life. And it's a documentary that tells a difficult story about what it's like to live with HIV. William Bronner contracted the virus when he was a toddler through a blood transfusion, something he needed after suffering serious burns. HIV affected almost every aspect of his childhood. And when Bronner headed off to Howard University, he decided to keep his status a secret from his classmates, friends, and sexual partners.
When I was away at college, I created a name, Reds. Reds was not Bill. Reds was not William Bronner. Reds was not HIV positive.
25 to Life follows a grown-up William Bronner as he faces the consequences of that choice and later his decision to go public as HIV positive. He's now the executive director of the Haven Youth Center in Philadelphia. It's a nonprofit that offers counseling and education to HIV positive young people. And William Bronner also joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So people obviously have really strong feelings when they see this film and when they hear your story. And just so we're clear, you talk about in the film about having unprotected sex with young women in some cases, or at least in one case, for years without disclosing your HIV status. So why put your life and these particular mistakes in the spotlight?
Being diagnosed, I always wanted to disclose, but I always had that fear of what would happen afterwards because of everything that was happening to people around me who decided to disclose. I'm sure you've heard the stories of Ryan White and, I mean, other stories of people whose houses got burned down, whose families lost jobs, who were kicked out of school, who were asked to leave their neighborhood. As life went on, you know, I made some bad decisions, some difficult decisions, and it was all, unfortunately, a way for me to cope with being HIV positive. And some of those coping mechanisms cause a lot of problems in other people's lives.
To your knowledge, do you know if you infected anyone with HIV during that time?
To my knowledge, I have not. We have gone on a search, especially since we created this film, to ensure that, you know, no one was positive.
At the same time, during this period, and we heard the clip earlier where you kind of refer to this alter ego you develop of Reds, you were not just trying to avoid isolation, you know, you went out to be a ladies' man. You really pushed it in terms of getting out there, being social, pulling women. It sounds like, you know, this was a huge part of college for you. Explain that mentality at the time.
Because I was so fearful of being isolated, I became highly social. And, you know, a lot of that had to do with, you know, women. A lot of that had to do with, you know, the player persona. A lot of that had to do with being that ladies' man that I thought would attract other people to me. And it was wrong. But it was the way I was coping. Maybe the better thing for me to have done in those moments was to seek professional help. But, you know, I'm 19, 20 years old. I'm thinking, you know, I've been positive for this long and, you know, I'm thinking somewhat of invincible and, I'm still 20 and I'm on this beautiful campus and, you know, just a whole lot of thoughts and emotions running through my head. I really can't pinpoint one thing or one reason as to why I did it. But I promise you this, I regret most of it.
Now, the film actually begins 3 years after you graduated from Howard University and 3 months after disclosing, making this public, which you do on a live radio show, actually. You decide to go back to Howard's campus for homecoming, and that was a really hard time for you. Here's a clip of you talking with your then fiance, Bridgette.
They're going to be seeing me for the first time, people who I slept with and forgot I slept with. You know what I'm saying? They gonna be able to see me for the first time. People who are now their boyfriends or their husbands or whatever gonna see me for the first time.
If I was one of the girls that you slept with and saw you for the first time, I would have something to say.
No, you can't. You can't say what you wanna say.
Listen, hear me out.
You can say what you wanna say, but you're not gonna be in my face like.
Well, you would have to humble yourself. You did some really bad things. So put yourself in their shoes. You know what I mean? Say that was me and you weren't positive.
So what do I say?
And I'm not positive.
So if somebody comes up,
humility comes in, Bill.
All I can say is, you're right, my bad.
That day you only stayed on campus for 30 minutes. I mean, take us back. What was going through your mind?
My mind was racing with a whole bunch of different thoughts, a whole bunch of different emotions. I was extremely fearful of all the decisions that I had made coming back rushing to me. But I felt that because I disclosed, I could no longer run from it. And, you know, Howard Homecoming is like the big deal. I mean, all of undergrad goes to Howard Homecoming. All of the alumni goes to Homecoming.
Yeah, so they basically shut down that part of the city.
I felt like that would be the perfect place for people to see me and address whatever issue that they had with me. But truth be told, I wasn't ready.
The film does certainly reach out to many of your classmates from that time, and they have a range of reactions. Here's some of that.
He's an attempted murderer, plain and simple. I don't care how much medicine was running through his system.
What would you do? You know, would you go to college? Would you go to Howard? And you say, hi, my name is Will. I have AIDS. You want to be friends?
He would have been the only individual on that campus who would let their status be known.
I think it'd have been a lot of phones pulled out, spreading the word, spreading the gossip. The face of AIDS is walking on our campus.
When you saw the film yourself and heard these reactions, did it bring you back to that place of fear? I mean, I'm assuming that some of the reason why you kept your status a secret is fear of isolation and alienation.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm fearful right now of who's going to listen to this right now and just, you know, get their emotions revved back up after years of, you know, this being put away for them. I'm always fearful of the reactions and the responses of people. One of the biggest issues of being HIV positive is not really the medication, is not really, you know, the fear of your own life. It's the fear of what other people think about you. I always say when I talk to young people who are positive, I always tell them that, you know, we put more emphasis on what other people think than we do on what we think about our own diagnosis. It's just because HIV is one of those highly stigmatized infections where the rest of the world does not look to HIV positive people with favor. So, yeah, it took me right back to that place. Every time I see it, every time I hear it, I'm listening to it right now, and my body's tingling like, oh my God, I don't know what have I done? Can we not put this movie out? Can we not do this? Can I take it all back? But the truth of the matter is, this is what I've been called to do.
And throughout the film, you also try and get in contact with old girlfriends to apologize, and some of them aren't interested. How did you deal with people who were still very angry? And now, looking back at the film, do you understand their anger?
I always understood their anger. In fact, I expected more of them to be angry. I'm just very thankful that all of them weren't extremely angry. As for the ones who, you know, could not forgive me and still cannot forgive me, I completely understand. You know, I took people's decisions away from them and how not only I affected their lives, but how my disclosure affected the lives of people around them. You know, a lot of these people, you know, heard this information through friends, you know, through them hearing about me being on the radio and then their friends contacting them. They didn't hear this from me. They didn't get, you know, the phone call or the knock on the door. They didn't get that. And it was my intent in doing that, but it just never happened. And when I went on the radio, I don't know what I was thinking. I was just so happy to finally be disclosing and finally, you know, being out that I never just took a step back to think about, okay, you have to make sure you get to everybody before you start. And to be honest, if I tried to get to everybody before I started and some of the reactions that I would have gotten back, I probably wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have come out publicly. You know, disclosing and coming out publicly are two different things. I could have disclosed to the people who I've had interactions with, but disclosing to the rest of the world, you know, was something I probably wouldn't have done.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing the documentary 25 to Life with William Bronner. The film chronicles his life after he disclosed his positive HIV status, a secret he kept for most of his life. And we should mention that one remarkable aspect is that you have had HIV for almost your entire life, and that it's never truly progressed to a place where your health has been in bad shape. I mean, that's what I gathered from the film.
Yeah, I mean, I've had situations where I have been hospitalized and I've had some opportunistic infections. But your typical person that you think in your brain when you think of HIV or when you think of even AIDS, I have not, thank God, I have not experienced those things, which is one of the major reasons why I decided it was time for me to publicly disclose. Because, you know, oftentimes we, you know, have these thoughts in our head of what someone who's HIV positive is supposed to look like. But when people see me, it's a shock, like, that's impossible. Not only is it a shock that's impossible, but when I tell them how long I've been positive, I mean, this film was literally made 5 years ago. So I'm 34 years old, which means I have been positive for 33 years. And in that, you know, I've been healthy, as you said. You know, I have my good days and my bad days. Like some days I have major stomach problems. But as far as those hospital stays and as far as, you know, everything else that people may think, I have truly been blessed. And this is why I've taken this platform, not only for people to not become positive, but for those who are positive to understand that you don't have to go that road. If you take care of yourself, you don't have to be that person in the hospital. You don't have to be that person suffering in silence. We can disclose, we can be everything that we wanted to be before we knew of our positive result.
Now that you're a counselor yourself, what advice do you give young people about when and how to disclose their HIV status? And have their fears changed any, even though, you know, we're many decades in now with people living with HIV?
So as a counselor, I take each relationship by a case-by-case basis because, you know, there's not one cookie-cutter description of how to disclose or when to disclose or when the right time is or so forth and so on. So when people bring this information to me, you know, we completely dissect the relationship. And, of course, we always strongly, strongly suggest that, you know, we disclose as early as possible and definitely before a sexual activity even occurs. But oftentimes with our young people, you know, they put the cart before the horse and they don't do that. And then we work on plans as to how to get this information to the people they've interacted with and, you know, what's the best methods to make sure things like this don't occur again.
The secrecy around your status did not begin with you. Your mother had a huge role in this. And at the time of your diagnosis, in the film, she talks about watching the coverage of how another HIV-positive child was being treated publicly. Here's a clip.
Ryan White is one of the main reasons why I knew I was not going to tell anybody about my son. Because what that child went through was just so horrible. Being a young black child with burns was bad enough. He had enough to overcome.
And for those who are probably familiar with Ryan White, a boy from Indiana who also contracted the virus through a blood transfusion in the mid-80s, and he became a poster child for HIV after he was expelled from school for having it. Now, as an adult and a father yourself, what do you make of the decision that your mom made?
Well, as a father myself, I completely understand it. I mean, times now are a lot different. I mean, people aren't being kicked out of schools and people aren't being, you know, thrown to the wayside as bad as they were back then. But in that time, you know, my mother made the best decision to protect her child. If I had publicly disclosed then, my life would not be the life that I've lived, not just with the promiscuity, but I would have been completely ostracized. And growing up where I grew up, I don't think my community would have accepted it either. So, you know, I would have probably, you know, been like a lot of other people who are positive and used that isolation and not taking my pills and not, you know, made sure I stayed as healthy as I possibly could be. I mean, a lot of these things happen psychologically, as we can see. And I don't think my family nor I was ready to handle that psychological breakdown of people knowing and, you know, stigmatizing us.
But some people will view this and see your mom not just keeping the secret, but at key points of your life being part of the denial and being a part of a culture of denial that your family kind of builds up around you. Was it hard for her to see this film? What kind of conversations have you had since?
It is extremely hard for all of us to not only see the film, but, you know, to go through everything that we've gone through. You know, we made the best decisions that we felt were best for the family and us at the time. We had no idea that it was going to blow up into what it blew up into. You know, hindsight is 20/20. Would we have all made some different decisions if we could have? Possibly. But at the time when we made these decisions, it was what we thought was best for our family and the people around us. But it is very hard to take this platform. It is very hard, you know, to make this film. But one thing I remind people of all the time is, you know, as I've said earlier, you know, we could have simply just disclosed to the people who, you know, needed to know, you know, my ex-girlfriends or my current girlfriend or whatever. But I decided, and my family supports me 100%, that this is a story that needs to be told for other people. This is no longer about me. This is no longer about us. We have to tell this story for other people so we could be those role models that we wish we had because we did not have them. It's about every piece to this story. If you talk to other HIV-positive people, especially people who have been positive for a significantly long time, we struggle with so much. And I feel like there's not been many people. I mean, we had Magic Johnson, and he's a great guy. But Magic Johnson was an NBA MVP before he was, you know, HIV-positive. So it's not, he's not something that I feel like we could ever reach. Like, I've always wanted to converse with Magic, and I have, but at a young age, it wasn't someone that I could aspire to be because Magic Johnson was MVP in the NBA. So I just wanted to put a face with it, to be some type of role model, to be some type of, you know, support that they can look to and say, if he can do it, I can do it. And yes, I've made mistakes, and I encourage people not to make the same mistakes I have. But I think, you know, all of that plays into why it's important that we have people that we can talk to about these things.
William Bronner, he's the executive director of the Haven Youth Center. He's also the subject of the new documentary 25 to Life. The film premieres this weekend at the American Black Film Festival, and he joined us from Philadelphia. William Bronner, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Audie Cornish. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.